Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Nationally, hate crimes are on the rise. The deadly aftermath of a white nationalist Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville last weekend has roiled the country. While a young man interested in neo-Nazi ideas has been charged with that murder, it was the planned removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee that triggered the protest and provided a focus for the violence. Until early yesterday, there were four Confederate monuments in the city of Baltimore. Mayor Catherine Pugh told reporters,
I spoke with the council on Monday morning. I said, with the climate of this nation, that I think it's very important that we move quickly and quietly.
All four statues were removed overnight. Later this half hour, we'll talk to a journalist from the investigative online news source ProPublica about its Documenting Hate project, which tracks and verifies hate crimes nationwide. But joining us now is Professor Lawrence Brown of Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy, who just last Sunday spoke at a vigil in Wyman Park in solidarity with Charlottesville. It was organized by Baltimore Block, a grassroots collective. Standing in front of the Jackson Lee Monument, Professor Brown called for it to be removed. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
What do you think the statues represented? What do they stand for in a city like Baltimore?
Well, I mean, you know, we had four statues, coincidentally, all in the White L, or where the concentration of our white residents live in the city when you run down York Road and then bank east on Alice Anna. And so they represented a sort of legacy of the Confederacy, but also the current legacy of racial segregation in our city. A legacy of white supremacy, a legacy of black exclusion, and a distortion of history. You know, these were losers of the Civil War being honored for their treachery, of betraying their citizenship to the United States while denying, ironically, the citizenship of African Americans. And so I think it's this moment is a jubilant moment for many of us. It's a moment of it's a victory. It's although these are symbols, they have meaning that I think is that carries forward to this time, and so it was important for us to wrestle with that and to depose of them.
Were you expecting it to happen this fast?
Absolutely not. You know, Mayor Pugh on Monday laid out, you know, this sort of slow-moving timeline. You know, she said, we're going to talk to the Maryland Historical Society and get permission from them. And, you know, we're going to find bids to see who's willing to buy these statues. So it did not seem at all that this thing would be this rapid operation overnight. You sort of wake up and are stunned that something like this is taking place. So I didn't expect it at all.
So you didn't expect it at the vigil Sunday night at the Lee Jackson Monument in Wyman Park. And part of what you told the crowd was this, quote, don't get caught up and too excited over just a symbol. What can we do to dismantle systems? That's our challenge today. I challenge each and every one of you, close quote. So you are exultant about the disappearance of these statues, and yet you've already publicly sort of put it in a context that this really isn't the core of what we need to do.
Absolutely. You know, we thought of it, Baltimore Block and other organizations, multiple organizations that came out for the rally. You know, we thought of it, I think, as a two-pronged fight, that we wanted to depose of Confederate statues, but also address the legacy of Confederate systems. So these systems of Baltimore apartheid, of racial segregation, of forced displacement, of tiffs for billionaires while black neighborhoods suffer. So we thought it was important to address the symbols, but then we needed to pivot to these systems. And so I think, you know, we're excited. You know, there's actually a group of us now that are in front of City Hall with the Baltimore SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and Baltimore Block and other allies. We're encamping out there to push our demands for a racial equity benefits agreement. So we're not just saying, you know, the statue's gone, everybody go home. We're saying this is the beginning. Let's push for real racial equity.
Mayor Pugh pretty much acknowledged this action was taken quickly because of concern that there would be violence or at a minimum unrest. So how do you pursue the agenda that you just talked about without violence being the motivating factor?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, especially because, you know, violence was the precipitating factor, the death of the young woman in Charlottesville.
Right.
You know, that really captured the nation's attention. And I think what she may have been referring to is that on Monday, activists in Durham, North Carolina, they just went and tore a statue down. And I think given everything that we've been through here in Baltimore, the sight or the notion of activists just going to tear down a statue here and then the Baltimore Police Department coming on the scene, that may have been a recipe for a disaster, especially when you have in the past 4 or 5 weeks videos coming out of the police department planting evidence on people. You know, our police department has been embarrassed. Our city has been under stress and strain after the uprising of 2 years ago. You know, we're in the middle of a horrific homicide spike and opioid overdose epidemic. So with everything that's going on, I think the mayor said even the hint of a negative interaction, I think, is what she was really concerned about. And so I don't know if it was necessarily violence. I don't think it would have resulted in that, but it could have been ugly. It could have been, you know, it's just people getting arrested and Baltimore yet again making the news for something that I don't think the mayor wanted the city to make the news for. So I think, but to your question, you know, how do we move forward without that sort of hint of violence? I think that, you know, it's important. We had 1,000 at least people come out on Sunday for that rally. And I think that was also a precipitating factor. There was no hint of violence, but it was just the sheer number of people and predominantly white crowd coming out, people passionate about, you know, this Klan vacation in Charlottesville and having these Unite the Right, multiple white supremacist groups coming together and people saying, we don't want that kind of America. We don't want that system, that legacy here in Baltimore. So I think, you know, maybe that we can take the momentum of this moment and perhaps pose the question of how we may be not just dealing with monuments, but the legacy that informed how Jim Crow operated in Baltimore, how racial segregation developed in Baltimore, how racial inequality developed in Baltimore. And I think maybe we could just take that momentum without any threat of violence, but just saying there's an urgency of now, and let's make sure we address and confront these realities.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Professor Lawrence Brown of Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy, an organizer with Baltimore Block, about the removal of Confederate monuments in Baltimore and what that means for the city. How would you envision doing that?
We're engaging in a campaign right now at City Hall. We are in front. We have red tents. We have folks without homes that are encamping there since Monday night. And we have a racial equity benefits agreement where we want the mayor to come to the table, similar to the process we had last year when the Sagamore TIF debate was taking place. We had work group hearings. We had meetings galore over this TIF because everyone understood this is important for the future of the city.
Well, TIF is tax increment financing.
Absolutely.
It's a kind of a tax break.
Right. So those TIF bonds, tax increment financing bonds, people understood $660 million. This is a mammoth investment. Let's take the time to discuss this. I think we need something similar, except this time we want the mayor to sit down with grassroots organizations like Housing Our Neighbors, Maryland Working Families, Showing Up for Racial Justice, Baltimore Block, different organizations around the city that are really plugged into different issues, Out for Justice, Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle. How can the mayor sit down with these groups so that we can craft the type of policies that are really needed for this city? And let's take a period of time to do that, 90 days, and then let's put those before the city council and let the mayor pass a much more robust and vigorous agenda for racial justice. So I think that's what our plan is. That's why we're camped out in front of City Hall, because we want the mayor to have this discussion with us. And we're nonviolent. We're here peacefully. But we are making the insistent demand that this should be a process that takes place.
And for people here in Maryland who saw those statues as history, What do you say to them?
You know, history is important. You know, history can be told and crafted in many ways. But I think when it comes to the public space, when it comes to who it is that we want to venerate and put on a pedestal, that we have to be very careful about who it is that we put up in the public space. Now, if you want to have a museum, if you want to tell the story of what used to exist in the past, there's absolutely nothing wrong with there. You can tell the Confederate story all day long and all day night in a museum. That makes sense. But in the public square, where my tax dollars go, where we are putting up examples of people that we aspire to be as a country and as a city, that's not a space for Confederates. That's not a space for white supremacists. That should be a space for folks who help overcome white supremacy. That should be a space for people who are pushing for racial equality, our gender equality, our sexual orientation equality. So I think that's, you want to put the best on those pedestals, not the worst. And so I think that's what I would say. You know, I'm not out for erasing history, but let's put history in its proper context. And in the public square, let's make sure we honor those who represent the best of who we are and who we aspire to be.
I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Professor Lawrence Brown of Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy. He is also an organizer for Baltimore Block. I'm Sheila Cast. This is On the Record. Quick break now, and then we'll learn about an effort to understand better how widespread hate crimes are. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about some of the aftermath of slavery, symbols of the Confederacy in public places, and how they fit into the larger picture of bias and hate in America. A coalition of newsrooms is working with the online investigative news operation ProPublica in what they call the Documenting Hate Project. Rachel Glickhaus is a journalist and the partner manager for the project. Before joining ProPublica in February, she worked at Univision, Medium, and the America Society Council of the Americas. She's also written for Al Jazeera America, Quartz, and Global Post. Welcome to On the Record, Rachel.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rachel, tell us about the Documenting Hate Project and who's involved in it.
We lead the project. We launched in January this year, and we have more than 100 newsrooms from around the country that are working with us to report on hate crimes and bias incidents all over the United States.
Tell me more about what those newsrooms are doing.
So essentially what we have done is built a central database of tips so that the public can submit directly to that database, and we're also gathering information from police reports and from civil rights groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and news reports from local media. And we're putting everything into this central database where reporters can get these tips and report them out in their city or in their coverage area. So we have many of our newsrooms are local newsrooms scattered all over the country, but we also have national newsrooms that have worked on stories looking at incidents happening all over. So essentially what we've done is built a database that we allow the journalists to use to report on stories of hate around the country.
Why did it seem important to do this now?
The idea actually came about in November. We at ProPublica had just finished a project called Electionland that was very much the same model. We had a coalition of newsrooms that we worked with to report on tips related to problems voting. So it was really focused on the election. And after the election, there was this spate of hate incidents, or so it seemed, happening all over. And the Southern Poverty Law Center in particular said that they saw a spike in people reporting hate incidents. So since we had just finished this very successful project with this model of working with other newsrooms, Scott Klein, who's a deputy managing editor here at ProPublica, came up with the idea that we could do this other project that focuses on hate incidents and use the same model of working in a coalition.
Is it not possible to have a picture, to have an understanding of hate crimes in America without this kind of special database?
Part of the reason that ProPublica decided to do this project is because during their initial research, they discovered that the data on hate crimes is quite bad. So the FBI puts out a report every year on how many hate crimes happen around the country. And in 2015, that number was close to 6,000 hate crimes nationwide. But the Bureau of Justice Statistics does a survey to look at how many hate crimes they estimate take place. And the Bureau of Justice Statistics puts that number at closer to 250,000 hate crimes per year. So as you can see, there's a huge gap in that number. And there are a number of reasons why it's hard to count hate crimes. One of them is that local and state law enforcement don't have to report their numbers to the FBI, and sometimes they just don't. So the FBI's data is lacking. And another reason that the Bureau of Justice Statistics found is that more than half of hate crime victims don't actually report to police. So there's a huge data problem here, and that was part of the impetus to start the project, because we wanted to see if we could help gather data and have a better sense of what the actual number of incidents really is.
What constitutes a hate crime that makes it different from another crime?
Are different in every state, but essentially, a hate crime law adds penalties for offenders who commit crimes because of animosity towards a victim's race, ethnicity, national origin, religion, gender, sexual orientation, disability, or other protected status. It's different in every state because, for example, in some states, sexual orientation is not included. So, for example, if someone says a racial epithet, that might not be a hate crime. But if someone says a racial epithet while they are assaulting someone, that's probably a hate crime. And we also have a federal hate crimes law that works in the same way. So essentially, there are additional penalties that are added for offenders if it is clear that they had some sort of animosity towards the person based on one of those categories.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Rachel Glickhouse, journalist and the partner manager for ProPublica's Documenting Hate project, which tracks and verifies hate crimes nationwide. So you're collaborating with many newsrooms. What has been revealed in the reporting you've seen?
We've had so much incredible work done by our partners all over. I'll point out a couple patterns we've seen. The first one we really identified that Univision initially found was harassment using the phrase get out of the country or go back to your country. And this is something we see again and again and again and again all over, in which people of color are targeted, whether or not they're immigrants, and this phrase in some form or another is yelled in an intimidating manner, or people are harassed, and that's one of the phrases that are used. It is the same type of phrase that was used by the man who killed an Indian immigrant in Kansas earlier this year, as well as the man who killed two people in Portland in a hate crime attack there. Another thing, BuzzFeed did a big investigation into, they did three stories about hate language in schools, in which children have used racial epithets and racist language and harassment to bully other students, mainly students of color and Jewish students and Muslim students, and discovered that they were also parroting certain elements of Trump's policies, like telling students that he's going to build a wall and he's going to deport them, that sort of thing. We've also done a lot of work tracking swastikas, which have cropped up all over the country. And also another thing Univision did recently was look at how Latinos have been targeted for speaking Spanish in public, who are sometimes harassed when they do. And we've also seen incidents take place on public transportation. So we've had a couple partners write about harassment that takes place on the subway or on the bus or on the train. And in certain cities, that type of harassment has risen, New York being one of them. And we have a bunch of partners working on stories right now that will be coming out in the next month or two with new patterns that we've seen.
So I'm getting the impression, correct me if I'm wrong, that most of the crimes that are going into your database are verbal? Am I wrong? Are there more physical?
So we haven't seen a large number of people reporting physical attacks to us. We see a lot of those types of reports in the news reports that we collect that have already been reported at the local level. But we get a very wide range of reports to us. So a lot of them are verbal in nature, so there's some sort of harassment or intimidation, but the person also may have been physically touched, but maybe not enough to, or harmed, but maybe not enough to go to the hospital. We also have had some people report that they were victims of assault or witnessed an assault. So it's a really wide range of types of things that we've seen.
You mentioned the reporting on public transit in New York, but your database is new. So how can you measure whether or not any of these crimes have increased?
The reporter on that story, which was the New York Times opinion section, got outside data to find out that that number had risen. So what she did was she went in and interviewed people who had reported tips to us to give a sense of what these experiences were like and what happened to them. And then she spoke to local authorities here in New York and got data from them. So we often have journalists who do that in their reporting, where they go in and talk to people and find victims of these types of incidents, and then also get additional data from their local authorities.
You told us earlier that there's a big problem with the data about hate crimes. Why don't people report hate crimes?
That's a really good question, and it's one we are trying to find out. I think initially some of the things that we've seen, particularly in the reporting process, is that some people are afraid. They don't want their names to be used. They might still fear their attacker or be afraid of the consequences of trying to advance their case. Some are humiliated, and they don't want to have to relive the experience over and over in the process of trying to get it prosecuted. And also, there are a lot of problems also on the law enforcement end. Police officers don't always investigate these crimes as hate crimes. The district attorneys don't always want to accept these cases, depending on what they are. So there's a lot of complexity involved, and it's a question that we really want to know the answer to, because more than half is a huge number of victims who don't report to police.
How long does ProPublica intend to continue this documenting hate project?
It runs through at least the end of the year, and we hope that we can continue the work into next year.
I appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Glickhouse, a journalist at ProPublica, manages its special project, Documenting Hate. We have links to ProPublica's Documenting Hate project and to Baltimore Block's Facebook page at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. Earlier, we spoke to Morgan State University Professor Lawrence Brown, who is an organizer for Baltimore Block. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.